Welcome to the Vortex Nation podcast, brought to you by lovers of hunting, shooting, public lands, the Second Amendment, and good food. All right, what's up, everybody? We're here in the studio in good old Wisconsin, Barneveld, USA. And we're here to talk about guns, which everybody loves. And we've got Nick Loffenberg across the table from Mark and myself. And what we've done is we've embarked on a journey that probably Mark and myself never thought we'd actually do here.
Not a million years, Jim.
The order of operations of this, too, by the way, you know, this is PodVenture. What hasn't COVID screwed up? If we wind up repeating ourselves a little bit, we actually intended to do this episode before we went down to Missouri to meet with a guy named Isaiah Curtis to build Mark's super Gucci awesome custom rifle. We were going to then talk about the rifle that I built with Nick, which is more of your quote-unquote entry-level precision custom rifle. But, you know, I mean, just with traveling and timing and this, that, and the other thing, it ended up being that we're recording this one afterwards. So, again, if you listen to that one and a couple of things we say here get repeated, I don't know. Now you just got it double times put into your head and your noggin.
Yeah, it's all about impressions, Jim. You know, you don't learn things just the first time.
We gave you double the reason in that case, or double the things to think about to hopefully get you on track to building your own custom long-range rifle. But here we are. So let's get into why we did what we did, though. That is one thing that we didn't quite fully address there. The idea here was that we wanted to kind of do a little bit of a, I guess, super Gucci high-end versus, you're more, again, like we said, entry-level, I guess, all relative.
All relative.
Yeah. And
just more of, more of a DIY.
Yeah, a little bit more DIY that we had with this. Certainly Nick and I weren't, you know, when we built this rifle, we weren't cutting the barrel or doing any of that stuff, but we did get parts and put it together, similarly to how someone would maybe get parts and put an AR-15 together. Not something you hear nearly as many people do with bolt guns as they do with ARs, correct, it seems, which is kind of interesting because we'll get into it a little bit when we put this together. Once you finally figure out the order of operations and directions and things, it's actually relatively simple to put together, similarly to an AR-15. So that was pretty neat. But we wanted to kind of do this comparison and see what you get for the extra money that would go into the custom route where you send it off to a gunsmith and essentially all the work is done for you and what's sent back is just this epitome of perfection, which we can all pretty much agree that is what Mark's rifle turned out a lot like.
Yeah,
I should have brought it in here. It's sitting at my desk right now.
No, you shouldn't have, because it would have upstaged mine.
Right,
and I want mine to take the limelight here for a second. So anyway, that's what we want to talk about. And I think we did find some interesting things, a little bit, you know, that followed what we would have originally anticipated. We certainly didn't think that this gun here with the components that we used would shoot poorly, but I know I was eager to see just how much better. You know, we've discussed that we don't have the exact price breakdown, but we're somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe $2,000 on this rifle.
Yeah, it's right in that ballpark.
Yeah, and then a rifle similar to what Mark had done is maybe your $6,500 to $7,000 price range. Just was really interested to see sort of how much more you eke out when you go that route. And then, of course, too, you know, time is money. Time is valuable.
Yep.
And Nick and I had to put the time into making this rifle to that point. To the point it's at now, Mark just got the opportunity to have somebody else do it.
Yeah, I watched somebody else work. Actually, well, you guys were there. It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was really cool, and you learned a lot.
And, you know, shooting factory ammo out of this thing, which, again, somebody else loaded up for you, that's pretty sweet. You're getting, like, quarter MOA groups with the 140 grain ELD match.
Yep.
We're getting close to that with this gun. Definitely sub MOA. Easy peasy.
I think this was actually, this one, when we were all said and done, was shooting about 0.3 minutes, and Mark's was shooting about 0.2.
Yeah.
So there was a difference, and differences that you'll definitely see downrange. In fact, there was one group of Mark's that shot, like, basically zero. It was three shots in the same hole.
It was.
But the important thing is when we look at these, both of these rifles comparing side by side, is this right here is a rifle that a really qualified shooter, or a very, you know, somebody who's going to be in the top 10 using a rifle like this isn't going to take him out of the top 10. This is something that somebody can put together themselves, take to a PRS match, and actually have a piece of equipment that is functioning and is good enough to get the job done. And it's not going to drag him down by any means. So as somebody who wants to get into that type of game or have a really high quality rifle, at a price point that, you know, I think is appropriate for entry level at that type of game. It's an expensive game anyways, but $2,000, including an optic, a fully ready to go rifle, is not much money.
Mm-hmm. Why is that? What is it about that? Like, when you're piecing this together, I remember thinking at first, I'm like, okay, we're going to build, you know, my budget long range gun, right? Mm-hmm. You know, custom, we'll do, you know, this route instead of going the factory route, which I think we'll get maybe more into. But I was thinking to myself, you know, let's try and keep it under a grand.
Mm-hmm.
And I even watched as you were piecing this together, and you're saying, you know, blueprinted Remington 700 action, we'll get this nice Remington barrel for it. You know, you throw a muzzle brake on, you throw a bipod on, a nice stock from, or a chassis from KRG, and then an optic on top. I'm like, we should be able to, maybe 1,200. And then right. It was 2,000 in the end, and I realized, that's kind of just the nature of the beast, because yep. nothing really that we have on here, I would say, is excessive.
No, it's definitely nothing excessive. I think some people might see the Arca rail on there and say, well, you could have gone without that, or, you could have got a cheaper bipod. And the fact of the matter is we could. But I think the goal, at least in my mind, was I wanted a rifle in the completed format that isn't, there's nothing about it that's going to say, well, I should have got that because this is going to hinder me. Mm-hmm. Nothing about that's a hindrance.
Right. It seems like probably the biggest cost goes into the barrel.
Yeah. A quality barrel, I mean, it's going to come down to tolerances. You know, one thing that we all kind of, I think we reiterated when we were talking with Isaiah was tolerance stacking, precise pieces, precise building. All those stack up to be consistency, and consistency is precision. And having parts that function in a consistent format requires precision, requires a lot more time and energy and effort and better quality materials to make a rifle that performs as well as this does. And this was very consistent, and I think with yours, you shot out at 700 yards, and that was about an inch and a half group.
Mm-hmm. And that was with me shooting. Right. I mean, let's and remember that.
I think, I mean, it definitely did the job. Now, of course, Mark's rifle is better and it's nicer, and there's a lot of reasons for that. Mm-hmm. But this is a hell of a rifle for 2000.
Yeah. And the really nice thing I thought for me as well is that I have grown accustomed to shooting other rifles that are probably tend to be, I mean, when you talk about entry level, we're talking about in general entry mm-hmm. level, not even just for PRS, NRL, whatever. And so I've gotten used to bolts that are super sticky and they don't feed super well. In fact, I'm very used to guns with bolts that don't feed ammunition very well. I've got some pictures of some bloody fingers, I'll tell you that. But anyway, you know, and triggers that get a little bit gritty and mushy, and, you know, then ultimate accuracy where you're thinking to yourself, okay, an MOA at 100 yards, like, I think we can, you know, work with that. I mean, putting this gun together and seeing it perform the way that it did, I was blown away. I was extra blown away when I saw Mark's, but I was still blown away at this, and then just the capability of it. There's something about having a rifle that's so much, I guess, just more accurate, and there's just so much less going on in the rifle that could screw up your shot. Where when you take that shot, it's so much more confidence inspiring. Because you think to yourself, if I put the crosshairs on it and break the trigger without moving the gun, it should go there.
Yeah, and it's just actually when we were shooting at the smaller targets yesterday, that was where I really saw Mark's rifle shine. Is that we were shooting at targets that were half minute of angle.
Mm-hmm.
So take out wind for one, mm-hmm. and then take out the shooter's abilities. Just the weapon and the ammunition need to be able to perform within a half minute of angle at those given ranges. And Mark's rifle, with a decent shooter behind it, is able to accomplish that. I missed that last target, and I know that I should have been able to hit it, but, I mean, one component that we did not really change from what would be considered a factory component is the trigger that's on that Remington 700. And it's an okay trigger, but we didn't adjust it down, didn't make any changes there, and it's sitting right around 4 pounds. That's a lot when you consider Mark's rifle, we had 8.9 ounces.
Yep. Yeah. That was the one component, you know, shooting both Jim's rifle and my rifle that I saw a vast difference.
Dramatic.
And we talked about that. if you get used to a trigger like that, yep. then that's what you're used to. And we talked a little bit about, you know, you kind of end up imparting, you know, just more human, more of the human elephant, or the human elephant.
I knew exactly what you meant.
That guy's that guy knows what I'm talking about.
I speak Mark.
That's my new band.
Yeah, the band name. You know, when you the human elephant. Anyway,
Andy Dwyer would be breaking down the door right now to steal that band name for any Parks and Rec fans out there.
Regardless of my words, it was dramatic difference, and I think that's a big thing that helped me shoot that other rifle better was the trigger.
Yeah, it definitely is. And in all honesty, you go to the good guys over there, like at Trigger Tech, and you pick up one of their, even one of their specials, which I think come down to a pound. It's not an awfully expensive trigger. And adding that onto the bill, like if this was my rifle and I wanted to change one thing about it, it would 100% be the trigger. And I would 100% being putting in a Trigger Tech special or spending a little bit extra money and getting the diamond trigger like Seth and Mark's. And
it's so
that's a
funny.
Pretty Gucci trigger, but it's not that expensive. And the change, the level of quality jump that you get by just installing that one little piece of equipment is dramatic.
It's so funny because I love this trigger.
I know you're nuts. I know. You're crazy.
I know. I, like, there's something about getting behind a gun, and I know it's a matter of just getting used to things because the human brain and body and all your kinetics and everything can get used to anything. But right now, I'm like 6 years off of shooting a Ruger American Predator, which is a fine rifle as it sits. But my trigger, and I actually do really enjoy that particular trigger, but I guess that's the thing, is a lot of people would say, you know, oh my gosh, you like that? But it's just what I've been used to, right? Like, I know exactly when that trigger's going to break. As I'm pulling the blade back, and I can kind of get my finger there, preload it a little bit, and then I feel this little, like, tick, and I don't know what that is, but then all of a sudden, I know immediately after... Immediately after that, click, it's going to break.
And I think they call that creep.
Sure. If you want to put, like, what are they, if you want to put...
sauce on a pancake?
Sauce on a pancake.
Human elephant?
Sure. Labels, that's what I say. If you want to put labels on it.
Oh, boy. Okay, well.
Anyway. I don't think we do that anymore, that's what Jim. I've gotten used to. And so I remember, you know, the first time I got behind a gun with this really light trigger, I just went to rest my finger on it, you know, because it's just kind of like, okay, you know, and of course we're pointing things in the safe directions, right? Yep. You're about ready to shoot by the time your finger goes on the trigger. But all I did was rest my finger on it. I'm now going from the point where, okay, the target is in the crosshairs and I'm about there to now like, all right, I'm going to do my fine tuning. Finger goes on the trigger, bang, it went off. And I can't do that.
Well, Nick, would you say like when you get to know a trigger, right, or you're... Like your trigger press process is going to be different for maybe each trigger?
Well, yeah. I mean, definitely how you approach the trigger, whether you can rest your finger on it or whether you know that when your finger comes into contact with it, any pressure is going to set it off. But it's really familiarizing you with that piece of equipment. Like that in Jim's gun, when I got behind that, I closed the bolt and got on target and I started squeezing the trigger and I stopped myself and checked to see if I had the safety on.
Right.
And I did it again, walked through the process, and I checked again, did I turn off the safety? Just because I'm so far away from using that heavy of a trigger.
Yeah.
Now, you're fairly used to it. The trigger in my competition rifles is set between 8 and 10 ounces. I have 10 ounces in my training rifle, and I have 8 ounces in my primary match rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, Mark's was set at, you know, 8.9, but then on an extreme contrast, you know, we got behind Isaiah's Six Comet for a little while, and he's got his set, I believe he said that one was 4 ounces, maybe it was 3 ounces.
He said three.
3 ounces. And he said, you know, he's so familiar with that trigger that it actually feels heavy to him. Now,
that seems impossible. That's like saying, oh, this helium is just
right.
really weighing me down.
Can't even lift it.
But if you put thousands of rounds on a rifle with that trigger, he said that one action has over 40,000 documented rounds on that action. I mean, he's probably had a 4 ounce trigger or a 3 ounce trigger on that action for that long.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just used to it.
Yeah.
I mean, acclimating yourself to something like that is important. I do not recommend anybody who's unfamiliar or less experience with that type of trigger, go and buy and crank it down to 4 ounces because you are causing a somewhat dangerous situation for somebody who's less experienced.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, somebody who's less experienced, like I said, at least the rifle was pointed the right direction for me.
Correct.
You know, and it was just missing by like a foot off the right shoulder of an IPSC target at 700 yards. But yeah, if you're not aware at all, and the gun is still resting on its buttstock, pointed up slightly, and you get behind, and a finger accidentally goes somewhere it shouldn't go, and
absolutely,
that's one thing where I do see if you're using an unfamiliar rifle, or your buddy says, "Hey, shoot this," man, dry fire it a couple times.
Yes. Absolutely,
get it in, obviously pointed in a safe direction, and dry fire it, and get a feel for how that trigger is going to break. And I'm no pro PRS shooter like you are, Nick, but I know that's one thing that.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, helps I laughed me at that. I suck.
No, I didn't. I didn't do that with your gun. I literally just got behind it, loaded it up, and started shooting. And the problem was that then I went and I rested my finger on it. Like I said, it went off. It surprised me. But mm-hmm. there's so much of like a big kaboom when it goes off, right? And you're not ready for it, so you kind of flinch a little bit. And I wasn't even able to figure out like how much pressure I actually even put.
Right.
Right. So then the next, I didn't think to dry fire. Right. So I just was like, keep shooting. Right. That's always a good answer.
That'll fix just about anything.
Keep digging that hole. So, of course, I load up another one. I'm like, man, what the heck happened there? I guess this thing's really light. And I tried to do it again, but it surprised me again. And I just never could figure it out because every time that the trigger went, an explosion happened. And I wasn't ready for said explosion.
Yeah.
And so then had I have just dry fired it a couple times, which I did with that 6 Comet at 3 ounces, I actually didn't shoot very well with your gun. And I shot well with the 6 Comet, I think, because I dry fired it enough times. I was like,
have to do. Not necessarily like punching the trigger like, okay, I'm ready for it to go now. But you do have some idea of when the trigger is going to break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That helps.
I mean, I walked in the shop this morning. I was like, you gotta let me see that thing. Cause they'd been hearing about this, this wonderful work of art rifle that we built with Isaiah the other day. And I felt like I'd set a trap. He's like, can I feel the trigger? I'm like, yeah, I feel the trigger, And I'm like, almost like laying in wait because I know Eric is familiar, like predominantly, hunting rifles and a little bit heavier trigger. And I was just like waiting for him to test it out. And he's like, oh my God, like, it's shocking. It's actually shocking how light it is.
Anytime I take my competition rifles to like a training class or something like that, and somebody wants to shoot my gun, I will always take that magazine out, open the bolt and say, dry fire it a few times. Because mm-hmm. every time somebody gets behind one of my rifles, even though I don't have mine set at the extreme limits, every time that person's first thing was, oh, what? That went off a lot faster than I was mm-hmm. expecting.
Yep.
And it's always better to have that little bit of surprise before they have rounds in the chamber.
Yeah. Get that out of the way before something's going downrange.
Yep. Yeah. Now, as far as, so getting back into what, okay, again, maybe this podcast is geared towards somebody who's looking into getting into the PRS game, the NRL, whatever, some sort of precision long range competition. Let's discuss factory guns, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not what this would be considered. You even made that point clear before we started on this. There is factory divisions within, certain competitive spheres where this gun wouldn't qualify because this is a custom gun, right? Yep. Factory divisions, hopefully, for those out there, it's a great way to level the playing field. You get, everybody's using something that was off the shelf, and there are plenty of accurate off-the-shelf guns. I know plenty of guys here with guns that are complete factory guns. Literally, I don't even know if they've done anything to them, and they're shooting sub half MOA with the things. Let's talk about that for a little bit. Like, why didn't we go that route? I think maybe some of it was the enthusiast in us who enjoys building something. I know that's how I am. As much as when I get, for example, a custom built, not by me, AR-15 in my hand, versus the one I built in my closet that I converted into a quasi gun room.
Mm-hmm.
I just always think to myself, why do I keep building my own? Like,
right.
This is so nice. But there's plenty of nice factory guns. So why didn't we go that route?
Well,
what would some good options out there be? Yeah.
Well, there is definitely something to say about something you put together, whether or not we actually quote unquote build it, but that taking all the components and putting them together into a functioning piece of equipment at the end does feel good when you're all said and done.
Yeah.
But one of the main reasons why I kind of wanted to go this route with this gun was for the people who want customized features. You get that barrel there. You can order it in a different twist. You can different length. So that's a big thing, is being able to specify exact component specifications, not necessarily like, okay, I'm going
to
pick...
Adhering to what a company factory says.
Exactly, yeah. Whatever they choose to be what you need, this is us choosing what we want. So the barrel length, the barrel twist, the barrel contour is all selected by us. The muzzle brake, that is from Patriot Valley Arms. That is an amazing muzzle brake, extremely efficient, and it's self-timing. So we were able to screw that on the end of it, time it ourselves, and just tighten it down. Super simple. In fact, it's basically hand tight, and it's good enough. They're wonderful. The chassis, this is from KRG. It's their Bravo chassis. It is one of their least expensive. However, it's adjustable enough with that adjustable cheek piece, and then having the ability to add on something like an Arca rail with preset bolt holes that are just ready to go. You just have to buy the rail, set it on there, tighten it down.
Just use the right screws, unlike I did.
Well, I think that was on me too.
We successfully made every easy job in building a rifle look extremely complicated.
Yeah, I really hope when you guys are finished with that it is not full length, because it'll be extremely boring and confusing and embarrassing as
You'll
hell
think
for
of
me.
Us but
with that Arca rail, though, I mean, the cool thing about that is that could have been, I mean, you guys took that step now. You know, you're saying, well, we could have, you know, spent a little less money and not gone with that, right? And you certainly could have, but that's also, if a person was going this route, something they could add down the road, too.
Correct, yeah. You can put them onto a traditional style stock, too. It'll just require some drilling, and it's not a big deal. I've done quite a few of them, actually, but this particular chassis, as it sits, is already pre-drilled and everything. You just had to put that piece on there and bolt it on, and it was ready to go. Again, not a completely necessary piece, but one of the reasons why I like an Arca rail on there, not only can I just bolt it right to my tripod and shoot off my tripod, but as it sits, if I, you know, if maybe I'm shooting off of a rock that has, that's not very long on top, so I need to have my front and my rear stable points close together, I can slide that Arca all the way up to my magwell. I can slide the bipod all the way up there.
Yeah.
Or if I'm shooting prone, I have a good understanding of how much bipod I need. I can slide it all the way out to the end and then have the absolute most stable position I can get. So it's just very adjustable. Also, it gives you a wider, flat base to place your bag on if you're going to be shooting with a front support bag, like off of a cattle gate or off of, you know, really whatever you're going to be shooting off of. That does allow you a little bit wider base to work on.
Yeah. And the custom aspect of it and the ease of customization really is an attractive point to these, because, like you said, I found myself in situations all the time where I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm going to get something that's relatively affordable, and this will be an easy way to get into something, right? Well, I get it, and I find, of course, in shopping around, and everybody knows, if you're listening to this podcast, I can guarantee that you've been in this situation. There's the thrill of the chase, right? You're chasing all over the internet. You're trying to find special editions of this, that, and the other thing. You're trying to find, you know, okay, I want this rifle, and I really like it the way that it is, but I wish it had a threaded barrel. Mm-hmm. Or I want it this way, but I really wish it was stainless. Or I really wish it had a lightweight contour. I wish it had this stock on it. And you're like, well, you know, no, I get like that stuff I can do later, right? And you get it. And then you get it, and you're shooting it for a little while, and then you think to yourself, it's just going to keep bugging me if I don't try it with that stock, or if I don't get the barrel threaded by somebody, or if I don't get, you know, and then all of a sudden, next thing you know, you're taking the stock off and you're buying another stock. So then let's say you went with a $700 rifle to start with, right? Yep. Now, okay, you're thinking to yourself, huh, look at that idiot with a $2,000 rifle. He wasted all that money. I got this one that's just as good almost for $700.
Right.
Well, now you went out and you bought the $300 stock for it. And so then you have this other one laying around that you're not going to use anymore. And so, okay, now you're up to 1,000 on it. And then you're like, okay, well, obviously I got to get an optic on there, you know? So then you get the optic and you get the rings. And then you're thinking to yourself later on, oh man, I really wish I got the Arca Swiss. And then you get that. And ultimately you wind up customizing it to what you wanted in the first place anyway.
Right.
And you end up spending the same amount of money. And plus then you got a bunch of extra parts laying around that are taking up space that you're probably realistically not going to use, even though you tell yourself, oh, I'll keep that for that one rainy day.
Everybody's got boxes of those at home.
Right. And then you're like, well, maybe it'll grow into another rifle. And it's like, well, if you grow it into another rifle, that rifle is going to be just like the one that you got that you didn't like anyway. So then you're going to customize that. So it just never gets used. Trust me on that. Just trust me.
It's a wicked spiral, Jim, that you're describing right
there. It is. Because the same thing happens with cars, right? So anyway, but you wind up just kind of doing it anyway, right? Because people want things the way they want it. And so I just like the fact that this, and going with the Remage style barrel, it makes, once you know the order of operations, it makes barrel changes pretty seemingly simple looking. I mean,
yeah.
It's literally a barrel wrench. You just stick on there and loosen it up, and you pull this barrel off. Because from what I've gathered, when I listen to the guys talk about competitive long-range shooting, I'm amazed at how often they go through barrels.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like some of these real, if you're thinking of getting really into this, like some of the pros, I mean, once a season.
I have, I have right now on my primary match rig, this is my second barrel this year. I got 650 rounds on it, and I have another barrel sitting on standby for when this one goes. And I probably won't get out of this barrel this year just because of how weird things was with scheduling with COVID and stuff like that. But in a typical year, I'll go through three.
Oh, my gosh.
What cartridge are you primarily shooting?
Six Creed.
Yeah.
And I typically like to pull my barrel around 1,500 rounds.
1,500,
okay. You can definitely get more rounds out of a Six Creed more than that, but I never want to go during a match.
Okay.
Yeah. Why leave it hanging and, you know, it might go any day now and I have a really important match.
Yeah, and you go to a national level PRS or NRL match, it might cost you up to $1,000 in fees and travel and everything. So why chance it to a $350 barrel I can just screw on? You know what I mean? Yep.
But, yeah, that is the one thing that I really like about this. It makes it easier because if you get a rifle that's, you know, already factory built, maybe doesn't have this nice barrel nut system like we have here or something like that that's really easy to change, then if you want to change that barrel, you're either getting specialty tools or you're sending it to a gunsmith. Mm-hmm. And when they put a new barrel on, it's going to be the same thing anyway, right? Unless you go, I don't know, unless you go, again, custom, and you wind up turning it into a custom rifle anyway.
Well, a really interesting thing about this rifle is this, again, is really definitely a custom rifle because it is parts and components that we put together based on custom specifications. It truly is a custom rifle, even though it's not as awesome custom rifle as, let's say, Mark's, but it is in the definition it is. And like, if you look at production division in, let's say, PRS, this falls way below the cost of like the limits for a production division rifle in PRS. Hmm. I want to say it's like $3,000 or $4,000 for a production rifle.
Oh, wow.
And that's because those production rifles can be made by a custom rifle maker. So,
okay.
And yeah, it's a fun one.
That seems like a, but it seems like a,
it's, as long as that you can go on and order that in the same way that you would be able to, like it's one that they have inventoried, you can go on and order it, it's ready to go.
Oh, okay.
It is technically a production level rifle.
They
as far as
make it perfectly and everything, but they're technically
right.
GA
Precision has one.
Okay.
They have Masterpiece Arms does one, Patriot Valley does one, and they're all amazing rifles, and they are custom rifle grade. But that fit into production division.
Yeah. So here I am thinking to myself, like, well, maybe production I could go in with the Ruger American.
You could. I mean, it's nobody's going to stop you from doing it.
Yeah.
But you know, you'll be way more competitive on the field with this rifle than you would with an actual, actual production, but what I think most people think of a production rifle by a Teak Attack A1 or
mass produced somewhere around a grand.
Correct. Yeah.
RPR.
Which are fantastic rifles. Yeah. There's some guys out there right now shooting Ruger Precision rifles that are just killing it, you know, putting in the top 10 at national level matches, which is amazing. So it can be done. But if you need to get out and you want to be as competitive as possible, maybe boost your ego a little bit to go to your next match, to take a real serious crack at it, this right here is a great way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. Yeah, let's say just real quick, though, for somebody out there who decides themselves, I really have no interest in just building my own, you know, for those production factory guns to get into something like that, what gun are you recommending them? I think you listed a couple.
Yeah, there's I think, three primary ones that come to mind right now. That would be a Ruger Precision Rifle. Mm-hmm. They're fantastic. I've never seen one that doesn't shoot good. The Bergara B14 HMRs, I think, are wonderful rifles. And Tika, I got kind of a love relationship with Tika. I think that for the money, you cannot find a better factory action. They're mm-hmm. amazing.
They're so smooth.
They're great. And their TAC A1 is yeah. right out the get-go. The only thing I'd change really about their TAC A1, as soon as I get it, I put an Arca rail on the bottom of it because I want a flat forend. But
all right. Fair enough.
Did we weigh Jim's gun?
No.
I don't think we weighed either of them yet, did we?
They're probably pretty close to the same weight.
Why is that? Because Mark's has a carbon barrel.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there?
Well, your barrel is steel, but it is shorter.
Okay.
Mark's is carbon, longer, and they put a weight in the forend.
Mm-hmm.
So where we did the trade-off, adding a carbon fiber barrel, I mostly did that for rigidity, although I did tell Mark it was to make it lighter. That was mostly so he'd still like me.
that was mostly so he'd play along.
Then he wouldn't have put a big weight in front of it.
Mark was right. like, no, not going to do it. And then we said, how about a carbon barrel? And he goes, fine.
Well,
sure,
so carbon is an interesting thing, carbon fiber barrels, because you can take that barrel and with Mark's is essentially a full cylinder. I mean, if it has taper, it's not much. And that barrel is, if you did a steel barrel the same length, same,
oh my gosh, it'd be a tank.
It'd be a tank, but it technically would not be as rigid.
Right.
So,
yeah, because it'd be made out of steel and
it'd be longer.
Carbon fiber is a very rigid material. So we were able to add length, add rigidity, and decrease weight. So that weight decrease isn't necessarily a good thing because we did want to balance off the rifle. So in order to properly balance it, I did insert a weight into the forend.
Mm-hmm.
And it did, I mean, just about a half inch for the magwell, maybe an inch for the magwell was the balancing point, which is perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, I found that to be just absolutely, you know, I don't really plan on carrying that rifle a ton, but that balance point, you know, and you were talking about how important that balance point is for shootability, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you're going to be using, if you're going to be shooting off of any odd, you know, whether it be, I use a cattle gate all the time because that's probably my nemesis, but if you're going to be shooting off of a platform where you're going to be using a single point with like a bag or something like that, having that rifle properly weighted is huge. If you had a ton of weight in the rear, for instance, you'd be muscling it up to try to get it into position the whole time. If you have a ton of weight in the front, you'd be kind of the same thing. You'd be trying to pull mm-hmm. that back end down, whereas you take Jimmy's rifle or your rifle and you take put that on a bag, on a prop or a barricade or a cattle gate or something like that, you could walk away from it. The rifle is going to sit there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to muscle in position, which is one of the most important things with marksmanship. One of the fundamentals is having a natural point of aim, and developing a natural point of aim when you're muscling things on the target is really difficult to do.
Well, and even, you know, natural rests like the crotch of a tree limb or,
absolutely.
you know, you're getting prone over a rock or
yep.
whatever you have that's going to provide, you know, a level of support to use as a rest, you know, just
I'm glad
like
you said
be...
tree limb.
Why?
I was expecting like the crotch of your hunting buddy. Guy does a handstand.
Don't shoot.
You know what? One thing we'll throw out this. Speaking of hunting buddy and whatever, the aesthetics.
I was just about to get to that, Jim. Mm-hmm.
Of my gun versus Mark's gun. Now here's the thing: both are beautiful.
Yeah,
I think Mark's gun looks killer in that like black and kind of silver color tone. I would just feel weird going out. Mark and I were discussing this, how awesome these rifles would be on an antelope hunt out in Wyoming or something like that, where you go in, yeah, sure, you got a little bit extra weight, but you find yourself the right spot and you have a lot of capability with something like this, you know, post up and
yeah,
execute
you're going to be able to execute shots with a high level of confidence, and depending on the hunt or the mm-hmm. terrain or how far you're going, it may not be a big detractor to carry a gun that's
exactly,
you know, as heavy as these are, and they're really not that heavy. I mean,
no,
I think we're talking about
they're in the ballpark of 12 to 13 pounds.
Yeah. There's far heavier guns out there on the competition circuit.
Oh, yeah. Mark's is probably a little bit heavier than Jim's just mm-hmm. because it does have a Gen 2 razor on it.
Yeah. But my pause there earlier is because I was like, well, you set up the gun. Then I was like, then what do I say? You don't lay waste. It's not like you, then you just fire away. I'm like trying to think of the, you know, hashtag respect the animal.
Yeah.
Anyway, but
send rounds downrange with reckless abandon.
Yeah.
That's not what we're doing.
No,
hashtag, that's not what
all.
We're doing.
Mark's gun is beautiful, though, in the four competition, like kind of tactical, sort of just badass. Anybody who's ever seen a sniper movie or played a video game with long-range shooting, it's, you're like, oh, I want that one.
It
right?
definitely has a very technological, futuristic type of, you know, the Terminator could have been carrying that thing around or something.
If I were out on the countryside with it, I'd just feel weird. I just feel like it, something about it. No one's even around looking at you funny, but it's just like I'm walking around like, man, I feel like I'm walking around with like a laser gun.
I mean, call me
from Mars.
Call me a traditionalist, but aesthetically, it just seems somewhat out of place.
Yeah, this one, this one feels at home in both. Again, aesthetically, and some people may have different tastes. Some people may have no qualms, and in fact, realistically
and
speaking,
you shouldn't. There's in the end, difference.
In the end, it's not like I'm not going to go hunting. You know, I wouldn't at all go hunting with Mark's rifle, but it's just there was something about this one where I was like, I just would feel less funny going out with this thing when I go hunting, and I also feel like it fits right in at, at a match.
And both would fit right in at a match, and I think depending on what guide or outfitter you're using, Mark's might work too, but I would say most most unguided hunts, you'd probably look like a pretty interesting dude out there in the field with that rifle. But I kind of designed the components and everything about Mark's rifle to match something that I think would be like perfect for Mammoth, you know, like the Mammoth Sniper Challenge, where you need a competition quality rifle where weight savings does matter.
Okay, gotcha.
You don't want it to be 25
exactly.
pounds.
So your rifle is set up the way it is because taking it to a PRS match or something like that, it would work wonderful. It's probably a little bit too much recoil in its weight as it sits. I know, right? Because it doesn't move much.
That non-existent recoil is far too much.
Yeah. The biggest thing is that it needed to be able to play in both markets really well. And that's actually going to be a pretty sweet hunting rig, too, if you ever decide to take it. Cause
you certainly could. You know, and it's interesting how, like, I mean, we're talking about this, and it's weird how you develop, I guess, like, what you picture as, like, you know, the purpose of a thing. Because it's really, it's aesthetics. Like,
it is.
Like, it's just an appearance. It's cosmetics. They both go bang. They're shooting the exact same cartridge at the exact same velocity, doing the exact same thing, nearly, you know.
And in the end, it's like, well, what are you going to do? Are you going to take a gun out there that looks better for the situation but it doesn't shoot as good? And you're like, well, no, I guess.
Right.
Right.
Here's another thing I'll ask you, Nick. I sort of know the answer in that we wanted it to be an even playing field between the two. We both chose 6.5 Creedmoor for these. Why did we choose 6.5 Creedmoor for these?
It's a great all-around cartridge. Does a lot of stuff really well.
Okay.
You can use it for competition. A lot of guys still do. It's a great hunting cartridge. And
is it already becoming like eye roll in competition, like, oh, 6.5 Creedmoor? Yeah, that came and went.
No, you
That's
still
so 2 years ago.
You still use that?
If for the type of competitions I typically do, most guys are shooting 6mm, whether it be a 6- or 6BR, 6BRA, 6GT. And it's mostly because they're very efficient cartridges that have very little recoil. We also have, in most cases, pretty heavy guns. Some guys still like a lighter gun if they can, but the guns are pretty heavy. And the goal behind that is when I pull the trigger, I want to, for one, if I can see the trace, I want to be able to watch a bullet in flight to the target. Two, if I impact the target, I want to see exactly where on the target I impacted. And if I miss the target, I want to see how much I need to compensate to get myself on target. And being able to see all those things when the gun's moving around a lot after a recoil of a shot is very difficult. If the gun doesn't move at all, it's really easy to do.
The more I've shot steel at some of these longer ranges, you know, and it's great. An impact is an impact, right? Got it. But being able to see, you know, oh, that was right edge of plate. Like, I barely clipped that thing. You know, if I want to give myself kind of, I guess, more of a margin of error, now I need to hold left edge of plate, perhaps, or something like that. So I'm centering that up. It really is interesting how important being able to spot those impacts
it is.
Yeah. And it's mostly to just raise your percentages of hits. So, you know, if I have, if I hit the target, that's great. But being able to see where I hit on it so that I can put my crosshairs in a slightly different point to ensure that my percentage of those hits stay on. Because I could keep on racking the bullet and keep on putting edge hits on there and they all count, but what if the wind changes a little bit and it takes me off the edge? No, I just lost a point.
Imagine being a basketball player and every time you shot a shot, you just closed your eyes as soon as the ball left your fingers.
Oh, you don't do that? I do that all the time.
Oh, well, I guess. But I'm just thinking to myself, like, if
that
I...
That actually might improve my odds.
Right, me too.
Well, if I'm looking at the hoop and I chuck up a shot and then I close my eyes, and then from there on, it's just kind of like somebody else just tells me, oh, you missed it, or like, oh, you made it. It's like, it'd be kind of nice to know...
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah. And so it is pretty telling as soon as you do find yourself, you know, obviously... Compared to what we've shot in the past, Mark, I think you found and I found that these recoiled far less. To me, it was. I actually didn't even register it on my internal Richter scale, but it was pretty evident when we were shooting that spinning target, for example, like 300 yards.
Yep.
Isaiah set up a spinner where, for those listening, essentially two steel plates. How big were they? Like,
I actually don't know how big they were. If I had to guess, they're probably a 4-inch on top and an 8-inch on the bottom, but I could be wrong.
Two steel plates on a spinner, and you shoot the one on the bottom, you get it moving a little bit, and then you got to shoot it as it swings back. You know, you're getting your timing up, the momentum of the swinger and all this stuff. And then
you're actually
eventually...
shooting at the spot before the plate gets to that spot.
Right. Yeah. With the end goal of, in the least amount of shots, getting it to go all the way around, right? And if you're shooting something like, I don't know, I got one buddy out there who has this super high recoiling rifle chambered in a dumb cartridge that he won't get rid of. But if you're shooting, you know, that guy's rifle, for example, you'd be, I mean, it'd be,
wait a minute,
boom.
Oh, you'd be completely off the mark.
it seems like, do you know? Do
we have some? I think I know the person you're describing, Jim, but I mean, you are right. I mean, with
boom,
that rifle, you aren't, you know, you kind of look up and you go, did I get him?
Yeah.
You'd have to get back on the gun. You have to figure out where everything was again. You'd have to, you know, knock yourself back into today. And meanwhile, by then, the dang thing is slowed down enough that it lost all of its momentum. And then you got to shoot it again and hope, you know, that eventually you can get it to spin around. Whereas when we were going, it was like, boom, and then you're already right back on the target again. You could hit it again and keep that momentum rolling.
Right.
Which I found was like a super good exercise for just maintaining sight picture and not moving so much after your first shot. It was a great exercise.
Yeah, it's I think Isaiah actually may have sold Mark a 6.5 PRC at when we were down there, just from, you know, a little bit more science behind it. But it's funny just how far cartridges have come over the years and how much more performance you can get out of something that might not beat the crap out of you.
Yep. Now, I'll say this, though. If you hit that spinner on the first shot with this cartridge that you're describing, you just need the one shot.
If
that's
you could be so lucky as to hit it. But yeah, the old, this is off topic, but the 6.5 PRC.
Yeah.
That Isaiah so eloquently
It sounds like it's
explained.
Got some interesting numbers attached to it.
Yeah.
I mean, when you carry more energy at 1,000 yards than 300 WISM.
I'm going to fact check it, but I'm curious.
WISM. But,
you know, that was like a good example, though. I mean, if you look at, I'm shooting a 6 Creedmoor right now, which is a great cartridge.
I'm a big 6 Comet guy.
That 6 Comet, though, he's got his, you know, it's just a perfect example. He's just got a modified 6 BR that is getting more performance out of that little cartridge and less recoil than my 6 Creedmoor. And it's just, you know, powder's getting better, bullets are getting better. Just the science behind case shape is getting better. And that's just a perfect example of it. You hardly know you're shooting that 6 Comet.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's dang efficient. I mean, he's shooting a 105 VLD at 3,050 feet per second.
Out of a cartridge that is like the size of...
Oh, it's cute.
Yeah, they're adorable.
It's cute. It's like one of those old...
It's
actually
like,
smaller than what I was about
I mean,
to
like
describe it as.
Full length with bullet, like that?
Yeah, it ain't big.
It's tiny.
Yeah.
I don't know. Find a picture of it.
We should have taken a picture
we
of it.
Should,
yeah, we should have.
We should have. No, I took a picture of it. We'll post it. We'll overlay it or
cool.
something. But, yeah. Shall we talk about the optics a little bit? We didn't even talk about that much with Isaiah.
Oh,
we were so caught up and mesmerized by him talking about all his gunsmithing. This one, we decided to put the Strike Eagle 525 by 56 on top. And honestly, can't think of a better rifle scope to do for this application and this idea. You know, you could throw originally I think I had like for cosmetics and in my excitement of just getting it set up. I threw a Diamondback Tactical first focal plane on there right away. Certainly can do the job. I've done 2 Vortex Extremes with that now and have no complaints. But hey, you know, I mean, for a little bit more and with a ton more features, the Strike Eagle is...
Yeah. Oof, it was nice. Way more fitting scope for this setup.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. You know, for your previous setup, like, perfect match, right? Like, all those things kind of go together. But this one, man, that scope is feature-rich, optically incredibly sound. It tracks super true.
Yeah.
The reticle is amazing. Like, when I shot your gun, I didn't feel, like, held back at all. 0%. Because of the optic.
No, yeah. And it's funny. I mean, like, we talk about it, and I don't intend to undersell the Razor Gen 2 that was on your gun at all, but, like,
right.
When you talk about going from a rifle scope that costs $700 to a rifle scope that costs $2,000, and you're going jumping back and forth between the two, and when I got behind both of them, it was never like this, oh, crap, I got to do all this readjusting or whatever.
Dang, now I can't see the target now.
Yeah, like, boy, I sure wish I was still behind that Razor. Getting behind the Razor, I do remember thinking to myself, like, oh, yeah, the Razor.
It's like, right.
It's like falling into some really, you know, like, comfortable bed. It's just your eye is so relaxed and everything looks good. But then I jumped back to the Strike Eagle, and I was like, oh, this is still great.
Yep.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah, that is one of the things that I love about the Strike Eagle most is that I have, of the rifle scopes that I own, I have more Razor Gen 2s than anything else. And if I had, at a glance, if you look at a Razor Gen 2 and a Strike Eagle, that Strike Eagle just looks like a black Razor Gen 2. So the guys that are really familiar with that particular optic...
Be careful now. A lot of people ask for those. And
I know, right?
Someone's going to rip that out of context and say, Nick Loffenberg from Vortex said black Razor Gen 2. They're clearly on the coming.
But, you know, somebody who uses that optic picks up a Strike Eagle, especially for a training rifle, or they want something more budget-oriented that still has similar features, has the same reticle.
All the controls are the same.
Yeah. Locking turrets. You have a zero-stop mechanism. They both roll 5/10 past zero.
Mm-hmm.
The mechanisms themselves are different, but they get the same job done.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They both have illumination. One has a locking illumination, the other one's non-locking. There's just the Strike Eagle's taking that Razor HD Gen 2 and taking all their features on there that are 10 out of 10 and making them 8 out of 8s to drop down the price. And so for somebody who wants to stick under $1,000, I don't think there's a better optic. They're amazing. I have one on a CZ-457 trainer, and I don't think I'd want to put a different optic on it. It just gets that job done as well as it possibly can.
Mm.
Totally. Yeah, and then, you know, we chose the Razor Gen 2 for years because it only makes sense, you know, when you're doing, you know, you're going all out already on the gun.
Mm-hmm.
You should go all out on the optic. Absolutely. And that Gen 2 Razor, I mean, you know, really, again, like Nick says, features-wise, on paper, not a ton of differences, but optically speaking, it just is... It's creme de la creme.
It's just a little, it's got that little extra sweetness to it. And that's kind of the common theme between, you know, the comparison when you compare these two rifles.
Exactly.
And actually, Jim, shockingly, you had a great car analogy. So maybe I'll just have you go into that with, you don't remember your car analogy?
I had a great car analogy at one point about that spinning target and pistons and stuff.
Well, you were talking about, like, essentially...
Is that what you're talking about?
No.
91 versus 87 octane gas.
That was actually another fantastic one, but not the one I'm talking about. You're talking about kind of like the Mercedes, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Both these things, they'll pretty much get you to the same spot, but the one just has a lot sweeter ride.
Yeah.
I've driven in a fast car that somebody hobbled together in their driveway, and it was like I got in, and it's like, okay, you know, that's a little bit pokey. That, you know, it doesn't feel like it's on there super solid, but gosh darn it, when he pushes on the gas pedal, we go very quick.
Yeah.
And then you get in that fast AMG Mercedes, and it's like, we go very fast, and when I'm in here, everything is really, like, man, plush. Now, this is not the hobbled together thing in the driveway like I'm describing.
No.
That's an extreme example. This
Isaiah's
is still nice.
Car analogy at the end I actually really liked. He said, right here you have a Ferrari pointing the Mark's rifle. And then he says, right here you got a pretty dang nice Camaro.
Yeah. So, Mark, you've been bringing up more car references than I have lately.
That's
so
crazy.
Hey, if anybody out there is going to yell at us.
Yell at
Mark,
me.
Yell at Mark now.
Jim's saying wisdom all the time. I'm talking about cars up is down. Cats are chasing dogs.
It's true. But actually, you do. There is also a parallel, too, with the rifles that we have here, because what you see is the jump up in terms of cost from going from this rifle to a rifle like Isaiah built. You look at it and you think, that's a large sum of money that I just jumped up. So you would think to yourself that you're going to jump up, you know, however, let's say that rifle costs 200% more than this rifle does. Some people might say, well, I'm going to get naturally 200% better performance. And it's like, to be really honest with you, probably not. And when you jump up, for example, in price from this Strike Eagle to that Razor Gen 2, you've jumped up more than 100% in price. You don't get more than double the performance.
No.
It's there's always these diminishing rates, you know, it diminishing marginal returns. Return
the law of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
Yeah. You do, as you get higher and higher in quality levels, more it'll cost you more and more money to get you a smaller and smaller amount of quality.
Mm-hmm.
It just does. That's how things work.
Simultaneously, as you get more and more experienced, your level of ability to discern tiny differences in things grows.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas I can't tell the stinking difference between an 8-ounce trigger and a 3-ounce trigger, Isaiah all day is going to be like, yeah, that thing's heavy. You know, or you even probably are going to be able to determine that, you know,
as you get better and better and better, not only may you discern those things, but those little things might incrementally improve your performance, like just that much.
Yeah. You know? Like, okay, I've gotten myself to the point where I'm good enough that now this little minute thing that used to just be kind of like, whatever, I'll live with it. It's actually the thing that's holding me back now.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you were talking about earlier that the edge hit, you know, you're shooting the plate and you hit the edge of it. Well, that's a hit. But that gun might not shoot quite as well or might not be quite as consistent as that full custom build. So that little margin of error could take you off the edge too. So it's just it's just playing percentages. I think when he was talking about building that rifle for Mark, was he was talking about getting everything down to absolute zero. You know, zero error, zero error, zero error. And anytime you add one instead of a zero, that's just adds up and adds up and adds up and compounds and compounds. And you have these little nuances that can decrease your percentage of hits. And, you know, the people that are at the top of their game, they want a piece of machinery that is going to be 0000 all the way across the board. So it just comes back to the shooter.
Yeah. One thing that I think is cool, like whether, you know, the gun Isaiah built or this gun here that you guys built, like they're both kind of purpose built for, I guess, you know, PRS, you know, competition, like long range shooting, right?
Yeah.
But
certainly fits into that category. Well.
It fits into that category, but it's certainly not limited to that.
No,
correct.
And I mean, long range is insanely fun. And
oh, yeah, you don't have to be in a contest.
You don't have to be in a contest or competitive shooter to enjoy or appreciate, you know, either of these rifles if you like to shoot.
Mm-hmm. I wish more people would put together bolt guns like they put together ARs.
You don't see them as much, but
you don't.
No, I would like to see more of it myself. I think there's something to say about a precision rifle that is really interesting.
Yeah.
When you get your first hit at, you know, 7, 8, 9 thousand, when you first time you take somebody out and they hit a target 1,000 yards, I think that just changes their life.
They might as well run a 4-man mile,
right? Yeah. It just makes them feel good, and being able to do that consistently though is pretty special. And something like this does it very well.
Well, and just hearing you guys talk about that process, I wasn't there for it. But you're like, oh, yeah, you know, a couple stumbles along the way. And, oh, wait, what's this part? Oh, we should have put that in 10 minutes ago. And, you know, doing a couple things twice. But, I mean, you guys essentially did the entire process one time. And just hearing you talk about it, you're like, oh, yeah, now if we did it again, it'd be like, boom, boom, boom. You know?
If we had all those components sitting here, we could probably throw that thing together in 10 minutes now.
And I bet it would have come out even better than this one.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's worth doing, and hopefully, maybe, after watching the video of it, after, you know, listening to some of the stuff we talked about with Isaiah and that other podcast and this one, if you've been interested in doing this yourself, you know, this is something that people out there are going to want to try. That's kind of why we wanted to do this. I know we have a little bit more shooting to do with these things. That's kind of the idea. We're going to try and set up a little bit of an obstacle course or borderline competitive thing here where Mark and I can test these things together. But
So for that testing, I believe the plan is to still use the 140s. Right? That was the
correct.
Both
the
guns shot
grain ELD match.
Yeah, both these guns shot that really well, and that's something that, you know, we kind of touched on a little bit before. The guy who's going to be setting up this rifle might just want to do it just because of all the, you know, the different parts that he can specify. Like, I want a 1-7 or a 1-7.5 or 1-8 twist. I want 26 inches. I want it an M24 or in this case a varmint contour. Reloading is another really important thing. This rifle shot, you know, about 3/10 of a minute. If I were to take the same rifle and do a little low development, I can make that group shoot a little bit better. However, you know, I take a rifle like Isaiah built, just because it's a little bit better in every way, shape, or form, it's going to get that little bit of a better performance even with that too. So that's just an important thing to keep in mind. This one takes a little bit more work, but you also have that completed product that you got to put together yourself and finish up.
And you learn so much about how stuff works when you do it yourself too.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, I didn't know a lot of stuff about how these things all went together, you know, when I was just buying factory guns that were already made, you know. Mm-hmm. And then also listening to Isaiah and him talking about how important certain things were with, you know, mating the barrel to the receiver and whatnot. So if you're really into this stuff and you really like it and you like tinkering on things and seeing how it all works, I think this is something you should totally try. You know, maybe decide not to build that 8th, 9th, 10th AR. Can't believe I'm saying this. and decide to try building a bolt gun. Good times.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a lot of fun. And it kind of makes me want to do another one myself.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. Well, with that said, stay tuned. I think we might even do, a little bit more video stuff. Who knows? But thanks, everybody, for listening out there. Let us know what you want to hear, too. So these pod ventures are for you. As much as it seems like we're having a ton of fun, which we are, we're doing it hopefully to help empower a lot of you out there to get out there and try something, break out of your comfort zone a little bit, learn something new. That's all good stuff, right? So. Yeah, let us know what else you guys want to be seeing, if it's anything else you want to see us do with these rifles or questions you have about how these rifles came together, how they came to be, whatever. We'd love to answer those. We got Nick here. He's in-house all the time. We can answer those, too. So hit us up on the Instagram page, at Vortex Nation Podcast, or in comments on YouTube. So
nailed it.
Awesome.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye.
All right, that'll wrap it up for this episode of the Vortex Nation Podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Hit that subscribe button so you can always stay up to date on the latest happenings over here at the Vortex Nation Podcast. Leave us a review or comment down below. We want to hear what you have to say about the show, maybe what you like, maybe what you didn't like, so that way we can make these podcasts as good as they can be. You can also follow us on Instagram at Vortex Nation Podcast. We'll be posting about each episode released, so that way you can go back, find these things, maybe grab a little nugget of information that you could take with you to the range, out in the field, or maybe to the kitchen if we're talking about some good food. So, again, everybody, thanks, and happy hunting and shooting. We appreciate it. Have a good one.